depend on another. Marcus Aurelius Meditations. Thank you all for being here. It's very early. At least it is for me. I'm half asleep. And today we're doing family and recovery, and we're going to show with our speakers tonight, this morning with our speakers this morning, we're showing how the family of 12-step works their program. We have an Alateen speaker, we have an AA speaker, and we have an Al-Anon speaker. Hello. That's fine. I was just saying hi. So the woman on my left, the Alateen, will be our first speaker. And without further ado, Claire, can you come up and speak? You got it.
There you go. Here's it coming. Hi, everyone. I'm Claire. I'm your Alateen chair for this year. So, do I just start speaking or do I announce the... Okay. So, when I was younger and my dad was just barely using, I said this last night in one of our meetings, and that it was hard that to put a boundary with him, because I grew up knowing him as like this sweet man who was my dad, you know, like he was there for me, he would comfort me, he would be the person that my biological dad was not, you know. My dad was not there for me, and so my dad now, my stepdad, he's always been there. But when I was younger, I never really understood, like, his abuse and his using until he finally got the help he needed. He ended up going to the Salvation Army, which was the recovery for alcoholics. All men in one household, duties like cleaning and stuff that they never thought they would have had to do because they were alcoholics. You know, they eat, drink, and sleep. You know, that's what my dad knew. And so we would visit him, and my siblings were like a couple years younger than me. They didn't really understand it more than I did. They knew, oh, I get to see my dad, you know, I get to go, I get to see him, I get to sing songs in church, and then we get to have ice cream. That's all they understood. But what I understood was that my mom was in pain because she was a stay-at-home mom. And when my dad left, she was by herself with four of us. There's five of us now, but my little brother wasn't born yet. But at the time, there were four of us. And so she was by herself. She didn't have a job. She didn't have a stable relationship with my dad. So she was like, yeah, you need the help. And I was trying to comfort my mom. You know, I would be there for her. I would make sure she was in a good place. But it was hard because being how old I was, you never understand what your parent is going through. I was maybe 10 at the time. And I was too young for Alateen. I was too old for, like, preteen. It was this in-between stage where I didn't really have anyone. And talking about, like, Alateen or Al-Anon or anything in middle school or high school is the hardest thing I think I've ever had to do, because kids can be cruel. They really can. You know, I talked about this with one of my friends, and she goes and blabs it to this other person. It's not fun, because these are your private, like, information, you know, like what you're going through, and you don't want people that you can't trust knowing that. So I tried to get as much help as I could, you know. For preteen, you know, I had one really nice lady who was our, like, preteen teacher, I guess you could say. She was my Jerry, basically. And so I was with her until I was about 11. And I've been coming to this convention for maybe 15, 16 years now. 7 years today in Alateen. It was 7 years today in Alateen. Actually, right now, like, at this time. It was my first ever convention first ever Alateen convention, like this, when I was 12 years old. I was looking forward to Alateen since I was, like, 9. You know, I was like, how old do I have to be? How old do I have to be? Because I was hoping the age requirement would change, you know? Because as much as, like, Alateen helps, we don't want it to become a babysitting service. We don't want it to become like a la carte, where you just go and you eat food and then you wait for your parents. You know, this is a space where you can talk about what you're going through and like work your steps and whatnot. You know, like, and so when I finally got into Alateen, I found that like these are the people I can talk to. You know, as much as I would love to talk to people at school about this, they don't understand. You know, the people that are here understand what you're going through. And so while my dad was using, I was here. And now my dad is chair-elect for 2024 AA chair, which is, like, crazy. I saw him this morning. He's like, look at my badge. I get to be chair-elect. And I'm like, I'm really happy for you. You know, I see where he's come from, and I see where my whole family has come from, you know. I saw where my mom started and where she is at now, you know. She speaks her mind more, you know. Back to when my dad was using, it was the lowest point in her life because they weren't quite married yet. I think they got married a couple years after he finally got sober and worked his steps and all of that. And I'm glad they waited, you know. I didn't want them to get married and it ruined that relationship because I see how much they love each other, you know, and I see how much they love our family. And, you know, I don't know where I would be at this point if it weren't for Alateen or if it weren't for AA. Even AA, you know, I find I've been coming for so long that everyone here is like, oh my God, Claire, oh my God, Claire, you're here, I love you. It's because this is where I grew up, you know, and I wouldn't have changed it for, like, anything, you know. Like, I feel like I would be in a very dark place right now. I wouldn't be going to my meetings. I wouldn't be working my steps. I wouldn't be making sure, like, I'm doing okay. Like, I used to put people above me. I used to put others above my feelings. Like, my siblings, when my dad was using, I used to put my feelings below theirs, and then below my mom's, and then below my dad's. So I was at the bottom of the tier, waiting to work my way up. And the only way to do that is to do it yourself. You can't wait for someone to be like, okay, I'm okay, you can focus on yourself now. No, because there's always going to be an issue. There's always going to be something wrong with someone else. And it's just going to bring back you bumping down the tier, you know? And I didn't do it to hurt anyone. I didn't do it to hurt myself. I did it because I care. You know, I care so much about my friends, my family, and all of that. And so, at this point in time, I'm so glad I'm here. I'm so glad I'm alive. I'm so glad I'm speaking to all of you in this room right now. I wish there were more Alateens in this room because there's like one. It's my sister, so
we appreciate you.
We love all you. But basically, the end of it is, I'm grateful for where I am in life right now. I'm grateful that my dad worked his steps. I'm grateful that I'm like in this spot. You know, I wouldn't have changed it for anything. So.
Okay. Thank you, Claire. and next we will have Hamza, our AA speaker.
I'm gonna set a timer. 30 minutes is a lot, but I love to talk about myself, so.
Hi, my name's Hamza. I'm an alcoholic.
In here, it's, you guys are Al-Anon, these are the people, you guys are the people affected by people such as myself, you know what I mean? And I look at, like, the history, like, the illustrious career I had as a drug addict and an alcoholic, you know? And it started at an extremely young age, which I thought was normal, you know what I mean? I started smoking weed when I was, like, 12 or 13. It was fun, you know what I mean? It was cool, it was casual. Parents didn't know anything, sisters didn't know anything. I was able to just like sweep it away, tell my mom I'm tired, whatever it is, you know what I mean? Eye drops, there was plenty of excuses and go-arounds like to continue using, you know what I mean? And I also was raised in a very conservative, like Muslim Orthodox household. So where there was like always a lot of I had like helicopter parents, you know what I mean? I had parents that were very like on the nose about what I did, but they were also very naive to like the possibilities of what children could be doing. You know what I mean? My parents always thought the world of me, like they thought I was such a good kid, which at the time, like I was, you know, on paper, it was like, yeah, I'm good in school, you know what I mean? I show up, I do dinner with my family, you know, I tick all the boxes of like a conventionally good child, you know what I mean, raised in that household. And then during all that, I had a lot of resentment towards my parents because there was always a need or a want or a desire to be like how other kids were, you know, because my parents were so strict, there was a lot of limitations on the things I could do. And I used to blame them a lot for my unhappiness, one as a child, as a teenager, and until sobriety, even as an adult, you know what I mean? There was never any self-accountability. There was never any moments of like, what can I be doing to remedy it? What can I say? What can I do? And so instantly what I did was I turned to drugs and alcohol. So in the beginning, it's cute. It's innocent. Like I'm smoking weed, 12, 13, having fun with my friends. And there's just this rapid escalation, which is not normal by any measure, you know? So like 13, I'm smoking weed. By 14, I'm freebasing morphine and smoking crystal meth before school. And I'm like, this is still normal. This is what all the teenagers are doing. You know what I mean? And again, because my parents are just so, they're like blinded by the love they had for me, you know? They would never have thought like I was doing these things. They just thought like, oh, he's more active now, or like he's doing other things, he's growing up, puberty, whatever it is, you know? But it gets to a point where you can't actually hide the destruction of that behavior for a really long period of time. And I was fooling myself. My parents like considered there was something wrong, but they gave me the benefit of the doubt constantly, and I took that for a ride, you know what I mean? Always like taking advantage of my parents' love and like their understanding for me, you know? And so I continue this behavior, and eventually it gets to a point where I'm like about 14 or 15 years old, and I'm getting ready for school, and my mom comes in, and I'm freebasing morphine before school starts. And she comes in and she sees me with like the foil and the straw, and she's like, what's going on? And I have the audacity to get mad at my mom, not for coming in without knocking, not for like interrupting me, but I was like, let me just be a teenager, you know what I mean? Let me just do what I'm doing. All the other kids are doing it. No other kid is doing that. That was just a really good delusion I had for myself, you know? And that was like, and it's just like crazy because I got away with smoking pot for so long, and then I do this and I got caught in that. So it's like my mom didn't even get to see the descent into like that chaos, you know? She just walks in and I'm doing like heroin and morphine, you know? And it just threw her for an absolute loop. She was in tears, like in shambles, and like obviously my mom is the one taking me to school every day, you know? And now she's thinking like, why is he up at 5 a.m.? Like, school doesn't start till 8. You know what I mean? Why is he doing these things? And so my mom's, like, taking me to school, obviously concerned. You know what I mean? Mom's like, all right, like, have a good day. And for me, I'm just like, I can't wait to go get even higher. You know what I mean? Because that's all I did while I was at school. And again, I always used to use the guise of, like, good grades to justify my behavior and my actions. Because I was studious still, given that my parents poured so much into my education. I had like tutors, private tutors. I used to go to like learning camps, summer school. Like my parents invested a lot in me, and I just saw that as an opportunity to take advantage. That's all. Like my parents were vehicles, you know what I mean? Vehicles for like my own destruction. Same thing. I have two sisters, you know, they were the same way. My little sister was really young at the time. You know, she was like 4 or 5, but I used to be like, I'll babysit. And then I just put her in a corner and I would sit there and get high and be like, as long as you're not like doing anything, it's good. And she would just sit there and watch me get high for hours on end. Because my mom and my dad both worked. They worked extremely long hours, you know. They're both really hardworking people. They came here like in the 80s, you know what I mean, from Pakistan. Like just like, they came from like severe poverty, you know, and they came here to like give us a better life. And for me, in my head, I was like, a better life is getting high on my parents' dime. On my parents' time, you know what I mean? That's what you brought me here for. You know, that's why you work so hard. That's why you work 15-hour days, you know what I mean? Is so I can get high and live the life that I feel like I want to live. And this went on. I got sober in 2018. I had a nice chunk of time. I spent 13 years using, you know, which was half of my life. You know, I spent more of my life high, actually, than I did sober because I started using at such a young age. And I remember there was just always these moments, my mom walking in on me getting high, me having the audacity to get mad at her, you know what I mean? My mom tried, like, sending me to a rehab, and that didn't work, you know what I mean? My mom tried sending me to rehab when I was, like, 14 or 15, didn't work. And then it got to the point where your parents try, like, so hard to help. They love you, you know what I mean? And they did everything every single night. My mom's, like, in my room, you know, like, on her knees, like, holding my hands, like, crying, like, begging me to stop, like, what it is that I'm doing. And all I can think is, like, you're getting in the way of me getting high right now. You're also killing my high, so I need to get higher again because now you've just ruined the vibe. You know what I mean? I'm just trying to be, like, flopped out in my room in your house, you know? And eventually, parents get tired. I mean, that's not, like, an insane expectation that your parents would get tired of your shit, you know what I mean? And it got to the point where my mom was, like, obviously resentful, angry. Like, she started just, like, absolutely ignoring me, but still every night in tears knowing what I'm doing, you know what I mean? Because she didn't want to physically see that there was nothing she felt like she could do. And the reality of it is, like, until I got sober, there was nothing she could do. There was no way, because at that point, one, I thought I was in control, which is insane, you know what I mean? I thought I was in control of my drug use. I thought it was all normal. It's all sweet, you know? And I remember when I was about 16 years old, I was in my room again, like, I'm just, like, really high. I'm, like, absolutely loaded, and I'm, like, drooling on myself. And my mom comes in, and my mom was very physically abusive. I don't put it past her, you know what I mean? I'm no longer like, oh, what, that's the reason I use. Like, no, like, at that point, it's like, what else are you really going to be doing? You know what I mean? You get frustrated, you know, you get disappointed. And I remember my mom came in, and she hit me, and she asked me, she's like, why do you keep doing these drugs? Like, why are you like this? You know, what did we do wrong? They didn't do anything wrong, you know? But I remember I saw that as an opportunity. I looked my mom dead in the eye, and my mom is a very orthodox religious person. I looked at her, and I was like, I do drugs so I can get closer to God, you know? And at the time, that's what I thought I was doing. I was lost. I was scared. I was confused. I was looking for a purpose and a meaning of life, an escape to cope with whatever it is that I thought this life was not offering me, you know, and that drugs would. It was like a safe, what I thought would have been a safe haven. And that whole time I was using, all I could think was, like, I'm using drugs to find myself. I'm using drugs to find God. And it wasn't until I got sober that I realized all of those events led me to the point where I can actually find God in sobriety. And it's like a tangible experience. It's an emotional, emotive response to life that I have, the connection I have with God now. And it took a series of just terrible decisions. If smoking morphine at 14 wasn't a bad enough decision, you know what I mean? I remember being 17, and I thought it'd be a good idea to go drinking and driving, you know what I mean, but responsibly. So I wanted to be a responsible drunk driver, and what I did was instead of taking, like, 7 shots of, like, tequila, I only took 5, you know? And I was like, I'm good to drive. One, I didn't have a driver's license. 2, I stole my dad's car. And 3, I was like, because I didn't take 7, I took 5, I'm safe. You know what I mean? And what I ended up doing on that night was I got with a buddy, we drive in the car, and me and him have this idea. And to this day, like, I don't know what, I mean, obviously I was drunk, so it's not like I was in my right senses, but I thought it'd be a good idea to street race a cop. So I flashed my high beams at a cop on the street, and I'm, like, revving my engine at him, and I think he's about to race me, and I just, like, take off, and this guy flashes his lights, and he pulls me over. And, you know, there's these moments, like, when I was using, where I just thought I was a lucky person, you know, never giving any consideration to, like, God or the people around me that are willing to help me and, like, save me time and time again from my terrible, terrible decisions. You know, I get pulled over by this cop, and instead of actually arresting me or anything of the sort, or impounding my car or whatever, he calls my mom. It's, like, 2 a.m. now. He calls my mom, and he says, hey, your son's been drinking and driving. You need to come pick him up. And all I could think was this, I would have rather gone to jail than have to deal with my mom right now. She's going to kill my high again and ruin my night. That's all I could think. I was like, this sucks. This is the worst thing that could ever happen. And so eventually she comes, you know what I mean? I'm like 16, 17 years old. It's 2 a.m. My mom is just so concerned. She gets up. The car is missing. You know what I mean? I'm not there. She thinks I'm, like, at home, because usually when I used, I would just use at home. Like, I didn't care. I was like, I'd rather just get high in my house. And I was very isolated as a drug user, you know what I mean, which is, like, par the course. Like, one, who wants to share drugs? 2, who wants to be around a person like that, you know? And so I remember being out, and, like, my mom, she's, like, rushing out of the car. I'm, like, sitting in the middle of the street with this cop. And She goes, like, what happened? And the cop goes, well, your son tried to race me and he's been drinking and driving. And she was like, and again, like, my parents are Muslim, so it's like drugs are one thing, but like alcohol is like an explicit, like, cardinal sin as far as my mother is concerned, you know what I mean? And she's just like drinking, like, and I was like, yeah, you know, I was having fun. And the cop goes, you know, honestly, and I always used to get told this, I never really believed it, and that also validated my behavior. People were like, he's a good kid, he does good in school, he works hard, blah, blah, blah. You know, and the cop was like, obviously, this guy, like, he seems like a good kid, it seems like his environment around him is what's the problem. And he was like blaming my friends, you know. And I was like, how dare you blame the people who sell me meth and heroin for my bad decisions? Those are good people. I barely ever have to pay money for the substances I use. They're obviously good people. And my mom was like, I've been trying to get him away from them. I don't know what to do. And the cop was like, your son is on a dark road if he doesn't actually make any changes. And my mom's like bawling in the streets, 2 a.m. Again, it's like, it says it in the book as well, you know, like, as addicts, like, frothy emotional appeal does not work. Medical harm does not work. I have overdosed multiple times by the time I was 17. None of that was a wake-up call. All the nights my mom comes into my room crying, begging me to stop. Never even considered the idea. Would never deign to think of stopping using drugs. The thing that I thought was saving my life, ironically. And so eventually, like, and I'm drunk, like, I don't actually remember any of this happening. I had a friend tell me, and I had a mom, like, my mom came in my room in the morning, and she was mad. I was like, why are you mad, bro? Like, what's going on? Like, it's 7 or 8 in the morning, like, why are you actually in here? I'm actually asleep for once, you know? And she comes in, and she throws a plane ticket on my lap. She's like, you're moving to Australia. You're leaving in 3 days. And I was like, what? And she's like, yeah, we're done. I can't deal with you anymore. This is, you know, like, what else are you going to do? And for my mom, the solution was sending me to the literal opposite end of the earth, away from her and my family, just to get away from the stress and the damage that I was causing, you know? Every single day, it was cops at my house because I was also selling drugs with, like, these people breaking into houses, committing, like, all these absurd crimes to justify and afford, you know, a fairly expensive habit. And so I wake up one morning, and there it is, that plane ticket. My mom's like, you're leaving in 3 days. And I was like, well, I better go get as high as I can before I get out of here. I don't know how I'm going to get high over there. And I pack up my bag. I say bye to my friends, you know what I mean, or my supposed friends at the time. And I remember being on the plane, and I was like, no, this is an opportunity to get clean. I'm going to do it. This is an opportunity. I'm in a new place. I can create a new identity. I'm going to be a new person. It was, I landed in Australia, my mom sent me over to my uncle's house, you know, and it's amazing the damage we can cause as, like, alcoholics. I can go 10,000 miles away to a person I've never seen and absolutely destroy his life as well in a matter of weeks, you know. And I get to his house, and he's very welcoming, of course, like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm his nephew, he's never met me, we've only ever spoken on the phone. I adored him as a child, you know, when I was very young, and I was excited to see him. And I think I stayed sober for about 3 weeks. 3 weeks, and then I got to the point where I was, oh no, don't clap for that. That means nothing. Yeah, I have about 3 weeks, and it wasn't because I wanted to be sober. It was because I was in a foreign country and I couldn't find the drugs, you know? So I get on a train, and I'm just, like, asking every Bob, Jane, and John, like, where can I get weed? You know what I mean? I eventually am 10 hours out the city. You know what I mean? And I'm only looking for weed at this point. That's how desperate I'm getting. I'm like, I'm gonna go far for this. And where there's a will, there's a way. And, like, the way addicts work is, like, we will work way harder to destroy our own lives and find drugs than we ever would put the effort into managing or fixing the problems that we have or repairing any damage that we've done. So I eventually find the weed, and boom, just like that, I'm back where I'm started. I'm smoking weed. A few weeks later, I find the dude who sells coke. A couple days later, I find the guy with the heroin, the acid, like, whatever. I'm back where I started. And now I'm using drugs at my uncle's house, you know, and he has 2 kids. They're 7 and 5. And my uncle, he was extremely patient. I lived in Australia for 5 years. For the first year, obviously, like, using drugs, you can't hide that, especially at the point I was at where, I stopped caring to hide it. So I was just using drugs in the front lawn, like on the front porch, you know, in front of the house. And all he would say is, please don't use drugs at my house. I have kids here. You want to use them? Go outside. Go anywhere else. And I used to be like, well, fuck that. I live here. I want to use drugs in my house. And I've already claimed his space that he so generously offered me. You know what I mean? And I'm like, oh, this is mine now as well. Everything in this world is mine. Like, everything is for me. So thank you for giving me this place to get high at. And that went on for about a year where I'm, like, showing up to the house drunk. I'm, like, talking to his kids while, like, I'm on meth and heroin. And I think I'm being good. You know what I mean? Like, I'm, like, I'm engaging with the family. You know what I mean? With no consciousness of, like, how that probably actually looks. You know, externally, I probably look like a madman, you know what I mean? It's absolutely insane. And eventually, again, I cause enough damage, you know, now I'm avoiding them. I'm, like, only eating at night. I'm avoiding any spaces around them, you know what I mean? Because it becomes fragile. It's, like, toxic. Like, who wants to be around a person like me? And then I have the audacity to be like, you've made this an uncomfortable living situation. You know what I mean? And, again, like, I've caused all this damage, and I wake up one morning. It's 6 a.m. I'm, like, in school. I'm in nursing school. You know, I'm doing my bachelor's in nursing at this time, which is why I went over there. I was like, I'm going to become a nurse. I'm going to clean slate. I'm going to try to pay back society for all the things I've done. I'm going to become a nurse. You know what I mean? But I'm a nurse loaded on drugs. You know what I mean? Thank God I never killed anyone. You know? And I wake up one morning, 6 a.m. It's, like, April in 2014. And he looks at me, and he's like, pack your shit. Get out of my house. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, pack your shit. I'm done with you. Get out of my house right now. And at the time, like, I don't remember exactly because I was high. Like, I'm like, why all of a sudden? You know, what's the sudden reason to get rid of me, you know? Still don't know. Doesn't really matter because all I know is, like, I was causing destruction and chaos wherever I went. Wasn't relevant exactly, you know, what the tipping point was, you know? And so he's like, yeah, pack your stuff and leave. And at that point, I'm like, I'm in a foreign country. I don't have any friends. I'm in the middle of school. You want me to pack a bag at 6 a.m. and go where exactly? And he's like, I don't care, but you're not staying here around my family and my kids. And I'm like, all right. And now at this point, I have to figure out what's worth taking, what's not worth taking. So, of course, I take all my drugs. I take a bunch of dirty clothes, not the clean ones for whatever reason. Take a few dirty clothes with me. I leave the textbooks because I'm like, who needs books in university? You know what I mean? That I just paid, my mom paid rather, like thousands of dollars for. I'm like, I don't need that stuff. I'm probably just going to sell it. I'll come back for it later. And I leave and I go out to the city. I get on a train. I head over to this library that's open. It was really cool. It's a 24-hour library. I ended up living there for like a year and a half. I get to this library and they have like internet access on the computers. And I'm like, because he took the phone. He was like, that's my phone as well. Like, give me my phone because he was letting me use that while I was there. And I get on the laptop and I'm like, I'm going to message all my buddies I use with here. They all think I'm so cool. One of them will absolutely give me a place to stay. And I start messaging these people. I'm like, yo, like, my uncle kicked me out. Like, fuck that guy. You got a place for me to stay? And then it was in that moment I realized, like, these people didn't actually like me. I spent so much time with them, you know what I mean? And I'm like, yo, can I get a place to crash? And they're like, no, I don't want you around my family. Like, I live with my parents. Like, you can't come here. And, you know, and then I think I messaged, like, 10 people that I thought were really close friends that I thought really, like, wanted to care. And maybe they did, but I was such an asshole. They're like, it's not even worth the trouble. But, like, every single one of them turned me down. They're like, no, like, sorry, can't be doing that. You actually owe me $40, you know. You know, and I go through these list of people, and now I'm done. I'm sitting there, and it dawned on me that I was like, I don't actually have any friends. You know, now I have no family either. And I'm sitting there alone in this library, and I'm like, what do I do? Like, I'm in a foreign country. I have no resources. I have nothing I can actually do. And so I start hitting up the homeless shelters, you know what I mean? I'm like, I need to adapt, I need to adjust, I still need to finish school. Somehow I still had that motivation, insane. And so now I'm going from homeless shelter to homeless shelter. This goes on for about probably 6 months. And one day I'm sitting at a bus stop and I'm smoking weed. And again, this is like one of those moments where it's like God's grace to me, which I absolutely rejected and took for myself and claimed as good luck. I'm a lucky son of a bitch. Good things constantly happen to me. There's always a failsafe. And I meet the person now that is like one of my closest friends, just a random person on the street. He stops and he chats with me. And I tell him, like, yeah, like, I'm homeless. I go to the school. Like, you know, like, life's really hard. And for whatever reason, he's like, you can come live with me. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, this guy's a savior. I'm so lucky. And I go and I live with this person. And of course, like, it's not just the family you cause, like, destruction to. It doesn't matter who's around. Anyone in your path, you know what I mean, is a victim of what you're about to do to them, you know? And so this random kind soul takes me into his home, and I just start squatting there with a bunch of other homeless people, you know? I'm like, yo, dude, you guys got to come over here. This guy just lets you live at his house and get high, and you can eat all of his food while he goes to work. It's fucking sick. You know what I mean? And I stay there. And I take complete advantage of this innocent person. He's like, yo, you're going to look for a job? And I was like, why would I look for a job? I live here. You feed me? I don't need a job. I can just, like, steal a little bit of your money here and there, and I can go use it to get high. And then I'm like, you ever try heroin? You know what I mean? This stuff's awesome. Thank God for him. He was like, absolutely not. He's like, what's wrong with you? You can't use drugs in my house. But he lets me stay. Because I'm taking advantage. I'm, like, essentially coercing this man, like, bullying him into, like, yo, you better, like, let me stay here, you know? And I keep staying there, and I lived there for about a year. And eventually, I get a job as a nurse. I got a job as a shift nurse. I was making $40 an hour at the age of, like, 22. I was making really good money. Any normal person would have saw this as an opportunity to get their life together, at least get their own place, you know, get themselves a vehicle, let's try to create some semblance of a life from themselves other than squatting in someone else's home. And I see this as, now I can get extra high. I'm making a six-figure salary as a homeless person, and I have nothing to show for it. At night, I'm going out, I'm gambling, I'm spending all my money on, like, cocaine. I have nothing of value or substance in my life because I'm like, I have all this money. All money is for drugs. I'm not eating food. I went, like, weeks without eating food, you know? I wouldn't shower even though I had plenty of options to. My life was in shambles. But I think I'm on the high road. I think I'm living life good. I've essentially made it. I'm a success story, you know? And this goes on for another year. In 2015, I get a call from my mom's lawyer. How they got in contact with me, beyond me. I get a call and I find out my mom is on the run. She's on the run from the FBI. And what I have found out is from the years of 2012 to, so it was 2016, till 2016, she had actually siphoned $10 million from the American government through proxy fake business accounts, and she was stealing all this money. And I remember looking at that, and I was like, I got very resentful at my mom, and I was like, how dare you go out? And she always used to tell me, you're going to go to jail because you use drugs and you break into houses. Like, you're going to be a criminal. And she turns around, and she's actually being watched by the FBI, and I grew very resentful. And I didn't see that as like a wake-up call to, like, want to go home and see how my family's doing. I was like, all of my actions up until this point have been justified with this one phone call. I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing. And I continue on, you know. I go back to using. My dad's trying to call me, see how I'm doing. He wants me to come home. I'm like, no. I'm living the good life out here. Of course, long enough, I lose my job. Of course, you know. Like, I can't even imagine that I ever did a good job as a nurse. You know what I mean? And again, thankfully, I never killed anyone. You know, because I was always loaded at work. And I now lose that job. I was living in my car. I bought a car for like $1,200. I was living in that car. And I was like, winner. This is how people do it. This is like living the life. And then I was really loaded. And I thought it was a green light. It was a red light. I take a corner and I get hit. My house is now totaled. You know what I mean? And I don't have car insurance because I was like, why pay for car insurance? It was only $20 a month. And I was like, absolutely not. $20, absolutely out of the question. I'm not doing it. And so I crashed the car, and I'm like, that's my house. Like, where do I go now? Boom, I'm back on the streets again. And now I'm calling up the dude I was squatting at, and he's like, I'm like, hey, can I come stay? And he's like, no, absolutely not. Like, what are you talking about? You know, and now my mental health is set in, you know, from the homelessness, the lack of food. I had drug-induced schizophrenia for about 10 years. From the time I was like 16 till I was about like 25, 26. And I'm 28 now. And I remember, like, now things are getting miserable. I've lost the job. I've lost the house. The reality of my mental health is finally truly set in. I'm kind of thinking about, like, the weight of my actions over the last decade. And I can't handle it anymore. I break down in the streets. Like, I'm crying. I'm, like, all over the place. And I have the audacity to be like, God, why did you do this to me? Why would you let me make all these bad decisions? Why would you let me take it this far? You know, not to consider all the times God tried to save me, and I just saw that as a plus one to continue using. You know, every time I overdosed, that was a wake-up call. No, don't use as much. Continued using that much anyways. You know? And I remember getting on my knees and I was like, God, if you take me out of this, I'll get sober. I'll go back home. I'll do anything. Just please get me out of this situation. About a week later, I get a call from my uncle. And he's like, how are you doing? And I was like, please take me back home. I can't do this. And he's like, oh, so you've learned your lesson? And again, I got mad. I was like, you put me in this situation. Like, this, it's your fault I'm homeless. You know what I mean? Not to consider my own actions. Why would I ever take accountability? That's crazy people stuff. And I'm like, yes, I've learned my lesson. He buys me a plane ticket. I go back home. You know what I mean? Seeing how my immediate family's doing, like my dad and my sisters. And I go home, and what I find out is, like, while I was gone and my mom went on the run, the FBI happened to seize everything we owned. They were living in a shelter as well, unbeknownst to me, because I also was homeless. And I come back and they're living with my cousins, you know, and eventually, like, my sister is now the sole provider of my family, and we eventually move into a house and we're living together. And again, I'm like, fresh start. I'm back here. It's been 10 years. I can do something good. I stay sober for about 2 days this time because I'm like, I miss my friends. Let's go see what those old chaps are up to. Give them a call. Boom. I'm right back on it. You know, I'm smoking weed. I'm doing the Oxycontin, the morphine, the acid, the coke, whatever it is, whatever substance was available. And I'm right back at it. And now I'm using my sister's very minimal money that she makes to support our whole family. I'm using that to get high. I'm stealing jewelry again. You know what I mean? I refuse to get a job. Refuse. Because I was like, working's for suckers. You know what I mean? Why work when I can live off of other people? And it's in 2018. And to this day, like, I now know it's God. But at that moment, I woke up on a Tuesday morning and I was like, I can't live like this anymore. I checked myself into rehab. You know, I smoked all my drugs. I got rid of everything. I was like, I'm checking myself into rehab. And I don't know why I did it. I think God gave me an opportunity, and I thank him every day that I took that option, and I took it seriously for whatever reason. I'll never know why. I check myself into rehab. I go into a 9-month rehab program, and while I'm in there, you know, finally I'm getting help for, like, my mental health. They've given me, like, the medications I needed. I'm seeing, like, a counselor. I'm seeing a therapist. They're working me through, like, the steps, and they're like, all right, so one of the main things you need to do is you need to get to NA, you need to get to AA, you need to get to a 12-step program. And I was like, what even is that? Like, I don't even know what that is. What does that mean? What are you talking about? I'm already here. You know, you guys are supposed to cure me. You know, that's why these places exist. And so I get in there, and I was in a rehab for a month. And it's now January 2019. And I'm like, this is good. I'm sober. I'm on medication. My brain's clearing up. I must be cured. I go out and I meet up with a buddy, and he's like, hey, can you take me to the liquor store to get something to drink? He's like, I know you don't drink or use drugs anymore, but could you take me? I don't drive. And I was like, absolutely, I can do that. And I drive him over, and he's like, does this trigger you at all? I was like, I'm cured, buddy. I got 4 weeks. This stuff doesn't faze me. I mean, do you. Indulge yourself. Indulge for me. You know, it's all good. And he's like, oh, but you're in rehab for drugs, right? And I thought about it. I was like, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. Of course I can drink. Of course I can. So we get a bottle of vodka and we go back to my house, and I tell him, I'm like, I'm just going to have one. Insane. When have I ever just had one of anything, of any substance, of any measure? And he's like, okay, like, no worries. And I don't remember that night, but apparently I took the whole bottle into the bathroom, drank it in the tub, and then tried to kill myself. From my mom's recollection, she was eventually back, you know, after being on the run. She served 3 years in prison, you know, and she gets out and she was home. And she's like, yeah, you went into the bathroom. Didn't lock the bathroom, though. So I think I wanted someone there. And I drank the whole thing and I tried to kill myself. Apparently, I was, like, shoving broken glass under my nails and, like, banging my head against concrete walls and, like, cutting my wrists and all sorts of fun stuff that I don't have any recollection for. Okay. And that was a wake-up call, finally. And I go back to rehab and I tell them, like, hey, I relapsed. And they're like, oh, okay. And again, another opportunity. God gives me a plus one. They don't kick me out. They're like, you need to get to an AA program now. And I was like, all right. And so I go to a young people's meeting in Upland, California. And I walk in and I meet my sponsor there. And he's like, hey, we're going to meet up on Sundays. Give me a call. And I was like, all right, I can do that. And I start working the steps, and he tells me, you know, he's like, this program works, and I can guarantee it. He's like, stay for the 12 steps. If your life doesn't get better, I'll pay for your relapse. You know what I mean? And I was like, okay, I'm going to show you this doesn't work. I'm unique. Like, this stuff don't work for me. I've tried time and time again. I'm going to show you this doesn't work. I do my first step. I do the second step. It's now, like, maybe March or something. You know, I've got about 3 months. He asked me, he's like, has your life changed? And I'm like, huh. Now I have a car that I don't live in. I've got a job again. And my parents kind of asked me how I'm doing now. And it's like, oh, okay, so that sounds like an improvement. We'll keep going. We keep going through the steps. You know, I get through to my fourth and fifth, which I delayed the hell out of, you know. And now it's like about May. And he asked me, again, every few steps he asked me, has your life gotten any better? And I was like, well, now I hang out with my sisters. I got a raise at work. I kind of have a couple of friends in the fellowship. And I don't want to currently kill myself for drink. So I guess, yeah, things have gotten better. Again, I go through it. And at this point, like, I'm starting to get my feet wet without realizing it. Like, you know, and now I've hit my sixth and my seventh step. He asked me again. I've got about 9 months now. He's like, has your life gotten any better? I'm like, yeah, I have furniture in my room now that I bought myself. I have money in my bank account. I can actually have a full tank of gas. I'm able to take care of the things I need. I'm helping my mom pay rent now, you know? And I was like, yeah, I guess things are better. But this is still bullshit. Like, this program sucks. Like, I'm miserable, you know? Like, I want to go back to using still, like, deep down in the back of my mind. Again, I keep going. I've now hit a year without realizing it, you know? Because I'm just like, I'm going to give this program a shot. He said this works. All right, I'm going to show him it doesn't work, but I need to finish the 12 steps before he pays for my drugs. Now I've got a year. I've hit my 10th step, you know, and he asked me, he's like, has your life gotten better? I'm like, oh, I'm a behavioral therapist now. I'm back in school. I work with disabled children. I have an actual relationship. I haven't mentioned my dad once. It's because my dad never wanted anything to do with me. And now I have a relationship with this man. I'm like hanging out with him. We're doing like things like, it sounds like a cliche, but he's like, you want to help me build this bird cage for the chickens? I'm like, absolutely. You want to help me clean the garage? I'm like, I'm there for it. Can you give me a hand at work? I need to ship some boxes. I'm like, I'm there. You know, things that I never thought I would ever do. One, helping someone, but two, my dad, like someone I never even like thought of. I'm now helping my mom like do cooking and cleaning. She's relying on me. She's like, hey, I can't go do this thing. Can you go do it for me? I'm like, of course I can. You know, I actually have time, money, and resources to accomplish these tasks. Very mundane. It's something as simple as like, hey, can you go to the grocery store and get some eggs and like milk? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, I could do that. Sure. And I'm continuing the steps, and I finished the 12 steps. Finally, I'm at a year and a half now. I finished the 12 steps. And he looks at me again. He's like, so what's changed? You finished the 12 steps. You ready to relapse? And it was in that moment I realized that I had about 14 or 15 months without using substances, and I actually haven't thought about waking up in the morning. I don't think about using drugs anymore. And it really just like settled in. I was like, oh, and I'm actually happy. I have like friends that I call people and I ask them how they're doing. You know, Selena can call me, you know, and she'll be like, hey, can you actually come drive an hour and a half to Los Angeles and lead a speaker meeting and come be of service? And I'm like, you know what? I can do that. I'm going to get up at 7 in the morning and I'm going to come over here and I'm going to see what I want to be of service. If there's anything anyone can ever take from something that I've shared, then I'm happy. God let me do my job. He gave me the opportunity to help someone else, which is why I didn't get sober, but what ended up happening when I got sober. I was able to help other people. I was able to do things that I was never able to do before. And I look at my life now. I'm about to hit 3 years, you know what I mean? And I look at my life, and I'm married to a woman I love. I have a child. I have an amazing job. You know what I mean? I get to have the healthiest relationship with my family that I never thought I could have. It seems almost like a cliche, you know, like I meet up with, because I moved into my own place, I meet up with my mom and my dad on Sundays, and I bring my son and my wife with me, and we barbecue together, and I get to ask them, like, hey, how's work? How's life? I get to chat with my sisters. How's school going? I get to actually share laughter and sentiment with these people that I never knew who they were. You know, I never took the opportunity to understand who they were as people. They were always only ever vehicles, you know? And I get to look at my life now, and it's amazing. It's like the miracles are, they happened even though I didn't want them to. Only because I did the damn work. I did the steps. And through that, like, God gave me everything that I thought, I didn't think I needed. You know what I mean? I didn't think I needed these relationships to be repaired. I didn't think I needed to be functional. You know, I always thought I just needed to be physically sober. You know, and now I get to live a life where, no, it's not sunshine and rainbows every day. There was a car accident on the way over here. Like, I was told to be here at 8, what was it, 8:30? I was supposed to be here at 8:30, and I left an hour and a half early, and I still ended up being late, and I was pissed. I was like, why is there traffic on the 10 on the way up here? Doesn't make sense. It's a Saturday. I planned this, and as I'm driving, I see there is a brutal car accident. There was a four-car pileup on the freeway, and someone actually died in that accident on the way up here, and there was a car on fire. And it just shifts the perspective, you know what I mean? I always think I have it the worst. I always think that, woe is me, you know? And then God just shows me what's happening around me if I step outside of myself. And there's a lot to be thankful for. There's a lot to be grateful for in the life that I get to live now. And it really humbled me. I was like, I'm complaining about traffic. These people don't have an opportunity to complain. They don't even have a car anymore. Like, God forbid, they don't have their life. And I'm complaining about traffic because I'm going to be a couple minutes late. And God gives me another plus one. This starts late. So I'm not even actually late, you know? And it's just such a blessing what the program has offered me in the last, like, 2.5, 3 years. And I'm always eternally grateful for what happened. So it's like, I don't know if there's any actual alcoholics in here. I don't know if there's anyone in here who has an issue with substances. But if you do, like, I promise you, like, if you get into the program, you get yourself a sponsor and you read the big book, it will change your life in ways you never actually imagined it would. And it'll create such a fulfilling and beautiful life for yourself, whether you want it to or not. Thanks for letting me share.
Woo! Thank you, Hamza. Okay, and then last but not least, we have Jerry, our Al-Anon.
Hi, I'm Jerry, a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Gary.
You know, we tell you this is a life program. I came in 15 years ago, and that night, I was dared to come to Al-Anon. Because I was in control. If the addict listened to me, the Alateen listened to me, everybody listened to me, I could fix your life. But I realized I didn't know anything. You know, I grew up in a household where we were perfect if you looked at us coming out of church. Perfect mom and dad, kids perfectly dressed, everybody well-behaved, well-mannered. God forbid we step to the left or the right. If you had my mother, if you stepped to the left, you got smacked to the right. If you stepped to the right, you got smacked to the left. Literally. That was my mother. I grew up around addiction I didn't even know. That's how come this disease is so generational, and it's so covered in shame, and it's sad that it is. But I didn't know that. I was 7 years old, and I don't know if y'all remember, I'm dating myself, little saccharin tabs that people used to put in their coffee. Well, my mom used to have a little shaker on the table. She used to always say, don't touch that. You're a kid. When you told don't touch it, what are you going to do? You're going to touch it. Well, 7 years old, I'm thinking, I want to taste what that tastes like. So I go to get one, and I'm about to pop it in my mouth, and I got hit so hard that it threw me. And I was like, what the heck? And she was a flaming crazy person. Don't touch that. Don't ever touch that. I'm thinking, okay. Unbeknownst to me, my mother was a Prozac addict. Had no clue. Explained later in my life when I realized, here's this old woman I'm taking care of. I'm going to help her, and I'm cleaning her house. I'm finding Prozac in these big bottles. I'm a nurse then. So I start calling doctors and figuring out, what is this? Why does she have, nobody dispenses that big unless you're in a hospital. I find out my mother's been on Prozac my whole life. Because she went into menopause early. She had 11 children, I'm number 9. So back then, doctors, psychiatrists, whatever, gave women who were hysterical, wasn't menopause, it was hysteria, Prozac to level them out. Well, my mother's that good at it. If one works, six are better. So my mother was so high most of my life, I had no clue. Because I thought all mothers were ragers and beat their children. What did I know? It's not like you went to school and said, does your mom hit you? Because there's shame. You're never told what happens in your house. You never share that your mother's crazy, your father's trying to save her. And believe it or not, unbeknownst to me, that's my first introduction to Al-Anon. My dad was a black belt Al-Anon. My mother was the addict. And we were confused, crazy, and scared. Welcome to the perfect addict family. But I didn't know that. I didn't know that addiction even existed. Especially if you grew up in a Hispanic family. They party, they get drunk, there's fights. That's normal. That's a party. That's a funeral. That's a wedding. That's life. I had no idea it was any different. But here I come. You know, I couldn't wait to get away from my nuts family. So, you know, I endure what our Alateens have to endure. I endure the beatings, the crazy fights, all the bull that goes along with the addiction of addicts and you not knowing it. You just think it's Tuesday. It's normal. You know, I think every family at Christmas has a fight and your mother throws the Christmas tree out fully decorated onto the street and Christmas is canceled. I think that's normal, right? No, that's crazy. But I also thought my mother was nuts. I just thought, you know, she's crazy. She's had 11 kids. I'd be crazy too. Why would you have 11 kids? I remember thinking, I will never have 11 children. I have one. But the sad part is, as a kid, you don't know what's going on and you don't know you have a right to ask. So I did what every teenager does. I stayed away from home as much as possible. And I knew growing up that education was the way out. So I worked hard, got out of school at 16, graduated, went to college, became driven, successful, perfect. I was a controller. I didn't use substance. I didn't drink. I'm allergic to everything in the world, by the way. That's the other reason why I didn't do anything. But I took care of everybody. I took care of my friends. I took care of my parents. I took care of my siblings. I made sure my younger siblings were never hit because I stood in front and took that hit. I made sure my friends didn't drink and drive. I drove them home. I propped them up, I rang the doorbell, and I left. They were home because I was an Al-Anon in training. You guys, I didn't get a black belt. I got a crown. I was the queen of let me take care of you. How can I fix your life? Nobody told me how broken I was. Nobody told me how the disease of addiction affected my life. I figured I wasn't using substance. And mind you, I had brothers and sisters who were, you know, partaking in this. You know, I had a sister we put in rehab. She took a trash can. You also remember one flew over the cuckoo's nest a million years ago? She took a trash can, broke the window, stole somebody's shoes and climbed out the window. And I remember sitting there laughing. She could have walked out the front door. She wasn't committed. I mean, that's how crazy this disease is. You don't see it. And I am thinking, it didn't affect me. That's their lives. I'm perfect. I'm responsible. I'm in college. I'm going to have a degree. I'm going to grow. I'm going to have a life. I'm not going back to that. I'm never going to have that. I'm going to have that perfect marriage. I'm going to have that perfect child. Man, was I delusional. Welcome to Al-Anon. I get out of college, and all my friends are getting married, so of course, that's what you should do. I find the first sober alcoholic I could find. Did not know what alcoholism was. Mind you, I grew up in addiction, but I didn't know what it was. You all actually called it alcoholism. I just thought it was partying. So I meet this lovely blonde, blue-haired Kendall, and I'm thinking I'm going to have a perfect life because I can control him. He listens to me. He thinks I'm smart. And he gives me all the money to take care of everything, which I do. What nobody told me was this perfect Ken doll came from 3 generations of alcoholism. And he was the 4th. Welcome to my life. I spent 10 years with him. He was in sobriety. He was in the program. I got introduced to Al-Anon because of him. So I go to my first Al-Anon meeting because I'm a new bride and I want to have this perfect marriage, and he tells me about his program and that he's in AA and he's in recovery. He's got 1 year sober when I marry him. I'm so proud. Because I think, well, you know, you're recovered. Right? Just like Hamza said, I'm here. I did my thing. I'm good. So we get married because I think he's going to be the perfect partner. We're going to have the perfect life. Because I believed every fantasy book I read, every Hallmark movie I saw, I believed the Brady Bunch was real. So we go get married. I go to an Al-Anon meeting, and I hear these women. He hits me. He does this. He does that. And I'm sitting there going, take a bat when he's sleeping and beat the shit out of him. What's wrong with you? Leave. But I don't understand. Again, I'm so arrogant, thinking I can control everything, that these women are broken and they're pathetic. Shame on me. So I left the meeting thinking, I don't need this, because trust me, he ever does anything, I'll put a bullet in him. You know, I'll go to... What I didn't realize is how much rage I had from childhood. I didn't realize how much rage I had from addiction, that I had no sympathy, no empathy, and no compassion. I was perfect. 10 years we're married. We separate because after 12 years of sobriety, he goes out. Now, I had no idea what that looks like because I'd never seen addiction in action, right? Man, what blinders I had. He left for work, came back 6 weeks later, and said to me, I relapsed. And I said, that's great. You're leaving. We're done. I had no compassion. I ended that marriage. I had a 4-year-old little boy. We were not going to be together. You were not going to put me into some pathetic path where I had to hold you up the rest of your life. He leaves, and I'm thinking, that's okay. I can be a single mom. I learned how. I'm tough. I'm whatever I have to be, I can do it. But, you know, alcoholism is funny. It follows you until you realize what it is. It follows you until you do the work of your life. As the Al-Anon, we may not do substance, but we do alcoholics and we do addicts. And so here I am 2 years out of this marriage and I think I'm okay, and I find my next alcoholic addict. Because, you know, I love these guys. They shine. In a room, they shine. They're the life of the party. They're charming. They're charismatic. And they make you think that they got it. So sign me up. I take this one on. And not only am I, you know, with him, he's got 2 little kids, twins, 18 months old. I'm a mom again. I have my own child, so I'm thinking, I can do this. My husband and I were together probably 10 years, the second husband. And he told me he was a recovering alcoholic, but he had 10 years sobriety. And I thought, okay. But I figured the first one only had 1 year. Well, 10 years, you're good. You're not going to do anything stupid. Yeah, guess what? He finds crack. Because I have, mind you, I'm a nurse. I deal with substance. So I'm thinking, you're not a crack addict. I see these people. They have no teeth. They got, you know, lesions. I'm thinking medically what's wrong with them. There's nobody in their life that loved them. You've got me, 3 kids. You should be wanting to just be everything you can be. You know, I'm the Marines. Nope. He finds crack and he relapses. But he comes home and he looks at me and he says, I want you to know, though, I'm not drinking. So I'm still sober. I'm like, dude, do you understand what substance is? Yeah, you're sober, you're not drinking, but you're smoking crack. You're trying to crawl into the outlet because you think you gotta hide. I mean, I'm watching this man do a delusional breakdown. And I'm thinking, I can hold him together. I have to hold him together, because that's my job. So, you know, I'm that good Al-Anon. I start looking for therapists. I start looking for programs. So he wouldn't go to rehab, because, you know, that would make sense. So I think we'll go to couples counseling. Because, you know, A therapist will help us. That's my logical, rational mind. So, I find the best therapist I can find in Woodland Hills. She is amazing. And she deals specifically with substance, because that's what I was looking for. And the first session, she looks at me, she goes, "You're the problem." I was like, "Pardon me?" She goes, "You're the problem. Why should he get sober? Why should he get clean? You handle the money. You pay all the bills. You pay for vacations. You take care of the kids. You deal with every problem. What has he got to do? He doesn't have to be a man. You took that away from him." I had no idea that I had emasculated this man and my first husband. Because that's what I learned being a Black Bat Al-Anon. We fix everything. We hide the shame. And we take your dignity in a different way. And we call it loving you. We can love you to death. So this therapist, I was so pissed. How dare you tell me it's my fault? And she says, "You need Al-Anon." "No, I tried that. I'm not a victim. These women are crying. He's beating me." She says, "No, you're a different kind of Al-Anon. You're an angry Al-Anon." I said, "There's different kinds?" So she dared me. "If you think you got it, go to this meeting." She gives me the address. Canoga and Dumas. And she says, "I dare you." I'm like, "Okay, I'll be there." She goes, "Matter of fact, I'm going to meet you." I'm like, "Oh shit, now I got to go." So I look at my husband, who's still not clean and sober. I said, "I'm going to a meeting." He goes, "What kind of meeting?" "I don't know, crazy people meeting. I got to go." It's New Year's Eve that I go to this meeting. And I hear my story. "I couldn't get away from you guys fast enough. This woman hit me in a way that I'd never experienced. I was sitting there shaking, trying to hide it. I was sitting there wanting to cry, holding it in. I'm digging my hands into, just waiting for that clock to move. The meeting's over, and I run out, as every new Al-Anon does. I sit by the door, I sit in the back, and I'm out. I go sit in my car and I cry, because I realized, oh my God, I am so messed up beyond belief. I hear my story about my mother. I hear my story about loving an addict. I hear my story about controlling, hiding the shame, making everybody look good. And I hear my story about my rage. I had no idea what a rager was. I had no idea. I didn't hit my kid. No, but I screamed at the top of my lungs. I screamed all the time. I screamed at work. I was not a nice person. Yet, I was good at church. I was good at Bible study. But I wasn't good in the real world. You know that person that you cut in front of? I'm the person you cut in front of and I go off on you back then. You're lucky I didn't kill you. I'm lucky I didn't kill you. But I didn't realize how this disease had affected me from childhood to adulthood. And I come into my, I'm thinking, okay, I got through the meeting, I'm good, and I pull myself together in the car. The next day's a therapy session. And I go, and she goes, "How'd you like it?" I said, "Scares me." She goes, "Why does it scare you?" I said, "Because I don't have it together. I'm that puzzle, the pieces don't quite fit, but it's epoxied over because it just looks good." She goes, "Are you ready to take the puzzle apart?" I said, "I don't know about that, but I'll go back." So I went back the next Friday night, and that night I heard my story again from a 60-year-old woman from Australia who turned out to be one of the sweetest women and still a good friend of mine today. I heard my story again, but this time she didn't let me leave. She caught me, and she says, "Let me introduce you to somebody." She introduced me to the nicest woman, Allison, and she was my first sponsor. And I was... But there's nothing in there, guys. So Allison is the nicest woman, and she tells me, "I'm going to guide you with love and grace." I had no idea what love and grace looked like. And my first year in program, I was that good Al-Anon I came every week, I did what I was told, and I raised my hand for service. Do you need that? I can do it. You need that? I can do it. And I realized you could raise your hand to death. By raising your hand so much in your first year, you forget to work on you. By raising your hand in the first year, you forget to look at you. And it's a really great way to avoid yourself in program. So my second year, I get a sponsor. I don't know if any of you know Joyce or knew Joyce. She worked at Central Office. She was my next sponsor. Joyce kicked my ass, pulled my covers. I hated her. I loved her for 10 years. Joyce taught me to go to open AA meetings, to go to open NA meetings. She taught me listen to the kids that are in the rooms of Alateen, because I had little ones that were in those rooms. Listen to the laughter. I realized I didn't laugh much as a kid, and I didn't want my kids not to laugh. I saw couples that were actually happy to be together, addicts and Al-Anon or whatever. I saw joy in the rooms of Al-Anon and in conventions that I didn't know in my life. And I wanted it. I was hungry for it. So here Joyce says to me, put your hands down and sit on them for 2 years. I'm like, what do you mean sit on my hands? I was not allowed to volunteer for anything. The only thing she let me do is go to a meeting, go to a convention, and I had to sit in the front row. Couldn't sit in the back, couldn't sit in the side, front row. I had to suit up and show up, get in the car, and I did. And I got such growth in that first year of program. I called Joyce my first year of program. Allison loved me into program. Joyce kept my ass in program. And I learned to have compassion. I learned to have understanding. And I learned that I don't have to control everybody. I don't have to control anything. The only thing I have to control is me. Because that's the only person I have control over. So my second marriage ends because he's not in recovery. And I can't save him, and I don't have to. But I don't have to subject myself to that. And it's not my job to be his anchor. And I spend the next few years working on me, keeping my kids healthy, safe, and in program. All of my kids went through Alateen. Thank God for those sponsors, because my kids put them through hell. Because I was their mom. So they learned from the best. But something miraculous happened in my fifth year of program. My son comes downstairs from the Alateen room. He's my oldest at the time. And he's standing at the door, and he's got tears. Like, this is a kid who's 6'6", crying, and I'm thinking, oh, shit, what happened? So I'm sitting in the, and I look at Joyce, and she says, go. I walk out, and I'm like, are you okay? And he goes, Mom, I get it. I go, you get what? And he goes, I get program. I understand. You didn't send me here as a punishment. You sent me here to be helped. You sent me here to be loved because you couldn't love me the way you needed to then. You weren't healthy. He got everything. And I was so grateful and so blessed. Because a sponsor, Betty Ann, had told me, you don't give him a choice. You get him in the car and you tell him you're going to Alateen and he's going to stay there. Well, my kid didn't argue with me. So I told him, you got to go until you want to go. Well, he wanted to go that night. He came down and he told me, I want to go and I want to keep coming. See, my son was the Alateen who hid his substance because he was still trying to chase his natural biological father. He was sampling what he had to do to be loved, because something in that drug took his father away. So maybe if he was part of that, his father would love him a little bit. And my son didn't realize it's a dangerous road. It's a rabbit hole that doesn't have an ending sometimes. I'm lucky and blessed because he found his way back with no help from me. The hardest thing I had to do is my son called me and he said, Mom, I'm on a 5150 hold. Help me. I said, got a pen? Yeah. I gave him the number to AA. I said, I love you. I will always love you. You're my son. But I can't help you. I don't have what you need. And when you're sober, call me. And I hung up that phone. And I cried. And I called my sponsor. And she said, you did the right thing. Because I knew that Al-Anon would love me until I could love myself and love my son. My son got his life together. And everything's going great. I'm in program. I'm doing the thing. Ex-husband's out of the way. Two ex-husbands, because, you know, I don't do it right. Here comes number three. He's a good man. God has blessed me, my higher power. Because I always say, God surprised me. And I always put my hand on the door, let God go first. The program has taught me that. And when I thought I was coming for one night on a dare, here I am 15 years later. And I give back to program the best way I know how. I became an Alateen sponsor. I've been a sponsor for 12 years. I love my kids. I tell parents, when your kid comes through that door, they're mine. You gave birth to them, but they're mine. Because somebody was there for my kids, I'm giving back that way. Because I teach my kids, you have a voice, and I want you to use it. You have a brain, and I want you to use it. I want you to have compassion, I want you to have empathy, and I want you to have love. And those three things first, I want you to have for yourself. Because I remember growing up and not being heard, not being seen, and tried to get so close to the wall that you wouldn't be seen because I didn't want to be hit. I didn't want to hear the fight. I didn't want to argue. And I wanted to say so many things as a teenager, but all I could do was run and get the hell out. So I'm grateful. I wish I'd had Alateen back then. You know, it's so funny. When I became an Alateen sponsor, I used to see people who I admired in sponsorship that were working with the kids going, are they crazy? Do they make you nuts? She goes, yeah, but they give you the most love and joy. I got to tell you, the last 12 years, I wouldn't change. I hate conventions because nothing ever goes right. But when you're a sponsor, you bring out the tape, the glue, you're MacGyver, and it works. But I see a side of recovery that scares me because it doesn't change. I see parents drop their kids off with no money, no this, no that. And they're here for 15 hours on a day. So I feed your kids. Out of my, you know, I take my kids to lunch. I make my kids have, I make sure they have dinner. I make sure they have snacks. I make sure they have a program. I make sure they get recovery. And I make it hopefully as fun and as understanding as I want it to be for them. Because I want my kids to embrace recovery. There is hope. Doesn't matter if your parents are crazy, your siblings are using, whatever. You can have the hope and recovery of getting back to life. You can have fun. You can laugh. And you can be in a safe place if it's only for an hour and a half a week or a weekend at a convention. You can know that when you walk through that door, we're going to love you, embrace you. Maybe not touch you. Some of them are a little touchy. But we're going to touch you in a different way. That's what program taught me. You know, I have a wonderful life today. I have a loving husband who's in recovery. We both work programs. He respects my program. I respect his. We have great, if somebody ever told me this was possible, we have code words. Like, he'll tell me, isn't it time for you to meet Susan? Which is, you're going crazy, call your sponsor. And I'll say to him, Pete's at the door. So we know, we don't have to say or engage into crazy shit because we have enough recovery and we work enough program that those two things would keep us where we are. And the other thing my husband understands is he says, when you do a convention, whatever you need, you got, just go. Because he knows it's gonna, he goes, it never works smoothly. Nope. He goes, and you get crazy, yep, and you don't sleep, yep. He goes, but you get happy, yeah, because I see kids in recovery, because I see alcoholics and addicts that I love. Because if it weren't for them, I wouldn't appreciate the life I have. I wouldn't have compassion for my mother. When I was growing up, I would have told you, when that bitch died, I'd stomp on her grave to make sure she didn't come back. Okay, well, when my mother got close to her time of dying, I was her nurse. I brought her into my home. I loved her and I nursed her. And I got to do a living amends. Because program taught me I don't have to keep that hate. And it's so funny, about a couple years ago, I was at this convention, and a woman I met, my first convention, God love her, came up to me. She goes, "Oh my God, you look so great." I said, "Thank you." She goes, "And you're so nice." I went, "What?" I did not realize I was so angry. It was on my face. It was in my being. It was in every pore. But program took that anger away, and it turned it into love. So I love when we say, we may not love all of you, but we'll love you in a special way, because it's so true. I was unlovable. I felt unworthy, and I felt unwanted. And program gave all that back to me. Plus, it gave me, I have one child and two stepchildren, but I am the mother of hundreds of kids in 12 years. And I'm grateful. I still keep in touch with a lot of my kids. Selena was one of my first Alateens, and now she's an Amius. I've got Alateens. I've been to their wedding. I've been to their baptisms. I've been to their graduations. I'm blessed because program has taught me the word of recovery. And recovery is a progress. It's a journey. It has bumps and roads just like our freeways. But if you stay on the course and you realize it is one day at a time, sometimes it's 1 minute at a time. But look at your life today versus where it was, and look at the progress you made to get here, and what a blessing it is to be here. With all the imperfections, we're perfect. So I want to thank you for sharing your morning with us, letting us share our stories with you, and to just say, you know what? Remember, today, you're lovable, you're worthy, and you're loved. Thank you.